So that's what. Earth.
I'd like to rescind my motion.
I was expecting that. Got
I take that back.
it.
Well, I think if I could say
Please.
something now, you mean
I'm done grandstanding.
thank you. Thank you. Well, I think you've done a good job this year, Stephen. I think all of you have, because signed all the checks, right? We've met
Yeah, and all
all of our
obligations.
responsibilities as a board. I don't do anything, so I don't know if it did it or didn't. But I've appreciated your candor and your intelligence and your dedication to this board. Thank you.
Thank you. That means a lot, Greg. Ditto. I appreciate that. Means a little bit less from you, but thank you.
Well, it probably does mean a little less.
Sorry. All right, if there's no further discussion, I guess this is the item we can move to the.
I have some comments
Oh,
as well.
please, please.
Thank you. Thank you, by the way. I think for the public too, just to hear what, kind of a stump speech for the president, and what our goals have been. These have been goals that we've discussed, and we haven't formalized them into a strategic plan, but especially in developing goals for our executive director, we're all on the same page with these kinds of goals and many, many others. I think he was saving us time. That was a short list. That was a long list. That was really the major goals and getting to the objectives. And I stand in agreement with those and think you've done a great board. We'll be supporting this motion to keep things. And as current serving vice president, I like to be a lieutenant to a good leader. It's my personality profile. I lead if I have to, but I'd much rather support a really good leader, and I feel that I have that both with our executive director and our president. So I'm happy to see us continue to make headway. And I really appreciated your goal. Don't get I'll reframe it that we're so lost in our harbor goals that we forget our recreation and conservation goals. And I really appreciate that. Those are forward in this agenda.
All right, moving on, I guess, is there any public comment on this item? Seeing none, I'll bring it back up for a vote. This is just a regular vote.
Sorry, one more question before we just to get clarity and also for the public. Because it's germane to who we vote into office or keep in office. Other than me, who else is up for re-election
This
this
for this year.
at the end of
I
this
think
year?
it's your seat and my seat are up in November. We
Just
don't,
take that into.
we don't do a November, we don't do a June primary election on this board. We just go straight to the November election.
Sure. But that just maybe germane to people in terms of like our longevity and whether we're, I'm not sure either of us are ready to announce whether we're running for re-election for another 4 years, but that might be germane to this. But we do reappoint these every year at the
Every
beginning of the
year.
year. Okay, so maybe it's not as germane. All right,
Commissioner
thank you.
Benson, the election is typically certified after it occurs, of course.
Yeah.
And it's been typical that we bring on our new board members if there is a change in January. So appointments would be appropriate.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
And for the record, I do intend on seeking re-election.
Thank you.
Right. So there's a motion and a second. And I don't know if it was meant Aaron has been acting as secretary and doing great work in that regard as well. It's the three that are coming up for election, but I would know is right.
Yes,
And
I
as secretary. All right. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed or abstained? All right, then I guess I get to continue to sit in the seat as we move on to public comment. This portion of the agenda allows the public to speak to the board on the various issues not itemized on this agenda. A member of the public may also request that a matter appearing on the consent calendar, which Next item be pulled and discussed separately. Pursuant to the Brown Act, the board may not take any action on any item that does not appear on the agenda. Each speaker is limited to speak for a period of 3 minutes for each item on the agenda. And then is limited to speak for a period of 3 minutes during the comment portion of the agenda regarding items of special interest to the public but that are not appearing on the agenda and that are within the subject matter jurisdiction. Does anyone care to make a comment? Also, this could be none, and do we have one online? And I think I didn't state, because you always make a good point of writing that on my agenda, but to make public or to raise your hand, it's star nine. All right, so then we'll move along to the consent calendar.
I move that we pass the consent calendar as.
Oh, go ahead. So it's the consent calendar is two items, adopting minutes for the regular board meeting on December 11th and approval of the employment contract extension amendment for the executive director. So we have a motion to.
I'll second.
Motion and second. Any discussion? Actually, we don't usually have discussion on the consent calendar. That's why it's a consent calendar. So all in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed or abstain? Hearing none, motion passes. Moving on to communications, reports, and correspondence.
No correspondence received this period.
All right. And do you have some reports for us?
We do. Staff's been busy. Clicker never likes me, so there we go. Okay, so briefly, there's been quite an uptick in leasing interest for warehouse and coastal dependent industrial space. Currently working with the county of Humboldt to respond to an RFI that's out. Really having a great relationship with the economic development folks over at county of Humboldt and working very closely, so I want to compliment them and also thank them. Forest WRX Alliance, again, this is low margin timber. This biomass cluster came forward and said we're looking for a forest product lab and structural testing lab moving along that, with Cal Poly Humboldt. And as we move along in this process, it's going really fast and furious, but it's very, very positive. They brought on an engineering firm to design their new facility. We've actually relocated. We were considering in the facility, and we're looking at demising space in the general warehouse now because they've learned that some of the structural testing equipment they may have it requires a 20-foot ceiling height, and we certainly meet that requirement. So really excited that we can continue to move that along. I reported last month that we shouldn't see any hiccups in our fuel dock here, but unfortunately that isn't the case. So there's a lot of dockside fueling going on. We have our marina manager, our facility staff watching very closely to those that are fueling and ensuring that we are up on all of our BMP materials as well as all our practices and doing a little refresher with staff. So we think this is a small hiccup, but we're seeing a lot of fuel going to vessels, and it's quite concerning. We have chip ship in, Prince of Nature. I'll actually be on the ship.
So sorry.
Sure.
Can we ask questions as you
sure.
go on
go for
the
it.
Topic? Okay, yeah. Yeah, just in relation to dockside fueling, what's our capacity right now to treat spills with our boat? I know our boats have been getting serviced. Do we have
an active vessel? Yeah, actually, as of today, both boats are out. That was just overnight. Uh-huh. The Port Authority boat will be back in the water tomorrow. We pulled it out just for a small maintenance item. We are not we when there's a spill, the district responds dockside. There are others that will respond, U.S. Coast Guard, and then we call in a unit. Currently, MSRC is located in Humboldt County, and that deployment would occur. And then we'd bring up command from out of the area, from the Bay Area. But we certainly have the ability to place boom on the Port Authority boat. We're well practiced in it.
Mm-hmm.
And so that is an option we have. Yep.
Thank you.
Hopefully I answered that adequately.
You did. I just wanted to update
a little more on that, just for interest. Dockside fueling for the commercial fleet has become very standard. And in fact, Fort Bragg hasn't had a fuel dock in 10 years. all fueling in Fort Bragg's done with trucks. And normally, when we do fuel with trucks, there's extra safety protocols that are boats required to do. So it's a lot safer than one might think.
Yeah, and to further that, we're speaking specifically about the people that are using 5 gallon containers to fuel their vessels, not somebody that would do a truck. Thank you for that, Commissioner. That's the big challenge we're seeing right now is a lot of people using the smaller containers. So picking back up, yeah, the Prince of Nature's in for a full load of chips at the Green Diamond Export Dock. I'll be on the vessel tomorrow, kind of looking forward to that, spending some time with our partners out at Green Diamond. There's a proposal to partner in a cutting room here at Whidley Island. I think this was brought up some time back. You'll remember that Megan, not Megan Kelly, Megan Kinney and Ashley Bellis came forward and presented to the commission on the dockside market, and it's really further the interest of additional processing. So we're looking at taking a small section of the maintenance shop and demising it for a cutting room, potentially leasing it to the North Coast Growers Association. We have a perfect size facility there that really is bonus space, has floor drains and plumbing. It's almost as if it was meant to be for this purpose. So we're doing a deep examination. If that's feasible, we could pass all the requirements set for such a facility, and looking to see how we can work with them to fund that. So it could be a good revenue source for our fishing fleet, and it would certainly cover the cost for the district to have that. So it'd be a very positive move forward in supporting the fisheries. And then we have the retirement of Rick Jukester. Rick Jukester retired as a harbor maintenance worker 3, our highest class of harbor maintenance worker. He celebrated 18 years of service with the district. As we say, you know, we lost a worker but gained a friend. And so we want to congratulate Rick on his service. Lots of hazards out there. We've had king tides, winter storms. There's recent fires in Arcata. I'll certainly attend a briefing tomorrow on the status of the fires. There certainly is consideration for any hazards that. Perhaps there's materials that entered Humboldt Bay. I think you're seeing news on this, et cetera. I want to compliment City Manager Merritt Perry and the Environmental Services Director, Emily Sinkhorn, and of course their teams and staff. But Emily was on the phone with me first thing Saturday morning, letting us know that they're definitely monitoring what's going into the bay, that they deployed BMPs around storm drains, et cetera, when high volumes of water were flowing during the fire. So, but just to have that outreach is very, very positive, and that's the kind of relationship that they're building with everybody there, and we're doing the same with them. So, just want to say thank you and compliment them. Hopefully, not saying this recklessly, with the very high volumes of water we've had, there's enough dilution there that we're not going to see a lot of effect from it, but we don't know. But they are doing the testing necessary to and monitoring to make sure that we don't have a lot of issues. A lot of damage in and around the bay in terms of king tides. We'll get into that in just a second. And I will say this, however, local Cal OES, National Weather Service here on Whidley Island, the communication was exceptional. There were a number of briefings. Everybody's been checking in with one another. There's been a lot of check-in from our elected officials at the state level. Very well supported. We did have a few issues, but people responded to them well. District staff is looking at some permit issuance enhancements. Basically, now a lot of times we issue our permits, but there isn't a lot of monitoring after or involvement during the construction or those things that we authorize. So we're looking to use professionals such as district engineer and district planner to go out and look at these projects during their course of construction and operation, ensuring that those things that are in our permits are adhered to. And we think it'll build a much better overall relationship, not only with agencies and applicants, but professionally with amongst staff. So we're excited to bring that back to you as we look at our ordinance. And again, ordinance review and updates. I'd like to work with the board president to appoint a working group as we update our ordinances. We wanted to do this last year, got a large volume of work because somebody liked to pick on our grants and took our attentions elsewhere, but this is something we really, it's time to do it. And so Mindy, Rob, and I are, you know, getting ready to commence this activity and work, and we'd like to form a working group with a couple of commissioners to do that, or other people that we think would be appropriate. Finally, just a quick few photos. We know we have a lagoon project in over by Mad River Slough, Wadloo or Wadish or Wadoosh. People pronounce it very different ways. And So we had a little bit of a blowout. That's a lot of water happened. So the photo on the left is Lamphere Road, is the road that intersects there on the far right of the left photo. And then you can see the channel up above. The area just up above that, where you see some grass area and a little bit of an existing body of water, that's the bigger restoration project. And we had a blowout there. And the picture on the right is Lamphere Road. Pretty extreme flooding. Again, put a call out to U.S. Fish and Wildlife, put a call out to GHD. We have a GFD staff member in the audience right now. Instant response. In fact, the response was so great that they were out there rebuilding the road because it washed out a large portion of the road. So thank you, U.S. Fish and Wildlife. Bill Rich and Todd Van Herp reported this to us. They were on site. I can tell you that this was a pretty big issue. This is not only taking a road out and limiting access in the area, we have live farms, we have live nurseries out here. This is a very important area for oyster production. And there's a lot of cleanup that has to happen, a lot of monitoring. But as of now, U.S. Fish and Wildlife and their team, folks at GHD, immediately on it. These are some close-ups of the next morning. So we had another flooding again after the road was rebuilt. So we had flooding Friday, road Saturday. Another big washout on Sunday. And the photo on the left to the photo on the right, that is about a minute and 38 seconds by the timestamp on my camera. So it happens real quickly. So that's the report.
Good evening. My report pretty quick this evening. Just recall back in May of 24, we presented this idea of a new program that we don't have the staff capacity to do, but to evaluate all of the creosote piles in Humboldt Bay, estimating there's around 5,000 of them. We had an intern this last semester that completed some preliminary mapping. And meeting with some Cal Poly professors next week to see about more interns to do additional analysis of that. If you recall, this is the Peach program, and presented all this to you before, so I'm not going to do it again. But there's a lot of other governmental entities along the West Coast that are further ahead than we are. These pink areas are the general clusters of where the abandoned creosote piles currently are. That's an example of one close to us here. And then working with a number of different agencies to plan a workshop for beneficial reuse in Humboldt Bay. San Francisco Bay's far ahead of us in this, and so trying to catch up and use dredge materials primarily to prevent flooding and sea level rise projects.
Nothing for me tonight. Thank
You. Is there any report on? I saw there was also significant flooding that happened in the King Salmon area with the king tides.
that is mainly a County of Humboldt project, as well as the support for the sewer overflow with Humboldt Community Services District. The Humboldt Harbor District does own a tide gate down there. That tide gate specifically relates to water coming out of the channel and going up closer to the freeway and up in the ag lands. So we aren't directly involved in the stormwater system out at King Salmon as a whole. With that said, there is a FLKS, Fields Landing King Salmon, working group the district's participating in, which is with Cal Poly Humboldt, County of Humboldt, County Building and Planning, and the Harbor District. And we're looking at ways to work and improve on that. Certainly, there's more capacity if we're able to dredge the main channel. Then there's, channels that go up in between the various streets there. So we stayed in pretty constant communication. There's quite a bit of information on it, but we're not a direct party on that part of it. We certainly, could be, not staffed to do that right now, but thank you. And I didn't report on that. Same thing in Fields Landing. There was a pretty significant amount of flooding. In fact, if you think of Railroad Avenue, which divides the town north and south, at the Jimmy Smith boat launch, water was all the way up to the restrooms. So that's the farthest upland part and went up a bit, from there. So pretty significant. With that said, there was quite a bit of marine debris, as I mentioned earlier. The Harbor District, ZNZ Marine, a couple private contractors, even through today, are very busy collecting it. We've got a large volume of timbers, logs, some marine debris, and then just general trash that washed up large, items out there.
Many of these king tides were ended up being higher than predicted, correct? I think. Or did,
We did exceed them, yeah.
yeah, I
Yep.
thought,
We've
yeah.
actually asked, so you'll recall that we had Troy Nicolini here from the chief meteor or the meteorologist in charge,
Yeah, with the
rather.
props.
Yeah, with his prop chair last time. I don't know, it's not confirmed yet, but we have another person who's quite knowledgeable in and around Humboldt Bay in regard to this, who will probably be coming to us in March to do a special, or excuse me, in February to do a special presentation. And one of the things we're going to try to do is a follow-up on the occurrence of these king tides and give some sight to that. And that's Humboldt Waterkeeper.
All right, commissioner reports. Start over on your end.
Nothing to report.
Right. Greg?
Sure. Just happy New Year to one and all. 2026 is there's a lot going on already, and we've just started. I just want to follow up on my work with the Sea Level Rise Institute at Cal Poly. We've had a number of meetings during Humboldt's winter break already, and similar-minded activities that Rob has mentioned, looking at beneficial reuse of sediments and just looking at sea level rise adaptations and conferring with some other coastal communities, especially Mendocino County recently. And so it's so there's a lot of learning going on both here in the district and in the larger community. I did notice I was out at Manila Community Park and just looking at the rack line, quite a distance, several hundred feet from the normal shoreline, or from the mean higher water shoreline, seeing seaweed wrack, eelgrass and the like, flotsam and jetsam all the way up, close to the ball fields or the former ball field. So it really got up there, more than I had ever seen before at any king tide events. It's real. Okay, that's what I've got.
Thanks, Greg. Greg?
I have nothing to really report.
All right.
Well, it's about time for crab season commercially, and there's been some interesting developments, although there won't be an official stance by the Department of Fish and Wildlife till tomorrow, I understand. But it was understood that the season would more than likely open on the 15th of January. It's already open for recreational, just the last few days, actually. The holdup for season opening and quality testing has been domoic acid testing. And it's unofficial at this point, but there's a significant rumor that there's another over 30 part per million crab was taken off Trinidad. So therefore, the area between Redding Rock and Cape Mendocino will be the only part of California that won't be open for commercial crabbing as of the 15th of January. And it requires two clean tests of that region in order to open the season. So minimum of 2 more weeks. The good news is by then I'm sure we'll have a fuel dock. Beyond that, it's difficult when you close basically an area centered on Eureka. So Crescent City will go fishing, Fort Bragg will go fishing, and we'll see how this works out. But things are interesting these days when with the whale entanglements and domoic acid and quality, a lot of variables. We're all hoping we eventually have a very safe season. That's it for me.
Oh, it's rough news. I don't really have anything to report. Happy New Year, everyone. I guess there is on the 19th, I've heard that directly related to the harbor activities, but Congressman Huffman will be having a town hall regarding offshore oil drilling and some of the things that have been in the news on that, and they'll be at the Warfinger building on the 19th. So with that, we'll move on to unfinished business, and we'll receive a status update regarding the Humboldt Bay Offshore Wind Heavy Lift Marine Terminal Project.
All right.
So just a reminder that we're currently in a temporary pause after the loss of the two federal grants. We are reconfiguring the budget with the state. That's going well as of yesterday, and we should be back in action by the February board meeting later this month. Also, you'll be receiving a report in the coming months about eelgrass mitigation. That's kind of a side project that's funded separately and permitted separately, and great progress is being made on that. And then just recall, as soon as the funding is back on, these are the primary activities that will be occurring. But what I want to talk about this evening primarily is community benefits. So there is a workshop, I guess, an event coming up at the Wharfinger on the 14th from 5:30 to 7:30. It'll be researchers from Oregon State University, Schatz Energy Research Center, and several other institutions. And they've been conducting a two-year study on how West Coast port communities think about offshore winds and expectations regarding community benefits. It's free, open to the public, pizza and drinks. So I thought this would be a good time for us to talk about what our community benefits. So there's a couple of different ways to define this. It is positive project attributable outcomes that benefit one or more sectors of the communities in the greater region surrounding a project, or investments, commitments, mitigations, activities, obligations, physical modifications that provide some level of benefit, or outcomes that offset impacts, share project value, produce durable social, economic, environmental, or health improvements, or value provided to affected communities, particularly those experiencing disproportionate project burdens. I want to remind everyone the district has a limited role in offshore wind, so there is not a single offshore wind project. Offshore wind projects, plural, will fall into multiple categories. There are ocean-based projects, port-based projects, and transmission-related projects. We have no direct influence over the impacts, benefits, or legal agreements associated with what's going on in the ocean or land-based transmission. We staff recommends that we do advocate for ocean and transmission projects to provide benefits. Just realize that we cannot control the negotiations or outcomes of those discussions. We are responsible for the heavy lift multi-purpose marine terminal project. Also, some thoughts about operator. So we do have an operation strategy where the project itself will be operated by a competitively selected third party, which we call the operator. And what is their role in defining and selecting community benefits for this project? It's three options. One, we can define the benefits before the operator is selected, and then the operator has to implement those benefits as a mandatory condition of the lease. On the opposite end of that, we select the operator first and effectively delegate authority to them to interface directly with the community and make all primary decisions regarding benefits without the district's direct participation. And then there's something in the middle where the operator is involved in the decision-making regarding the final selection of formal benefits. This decision needs to be a future agenda item. We're not going to, definitely not going to vote on this tonight. I recommend that we don't discuss that in great detail. Just be aware that that's an important factor that is going to be part of this conversation at some point. So we're not seeking direction regarding this until the future. Types of community benefits. So benefits fall into a couple of different categories. One are just natural benefits or inevitable and inherent outcomes that don't require any changes to the project. So jobs will be created. That is a benefit to our community. It is natural. It's inherent. There's nothing we can do to stop it. It just happens. Then there are built-in benefits. These are things that we choose to add to the project strategically for the benefit of third parties. We are building a trail between our project and the neighboring community, kind of as a buffer between us and the neighboring community, and it benefits the community. Safe route to school. There's a lot of benefits that we have built in voluntarily to the project. Then there are community benefit programs. These are official, ongoing, systematic, supplemental activities to provide benefits over time. The Headwaters Fund is an example. And then there are community benefit agreements, which are formal, legal, contractual agreements designed to explicitly benefit specific groups for designated purposes. Be aware that community benefit agreements or CBA, there's also tribal benefit agreements. There are good neighbor agreements. When I refer to community benefit agreements, it kind of captures all of those. So looking at natural benefits, we're going to have a lot of natural benefits just by fulfilling the core purpose of the project. And I think that these are often forgotten when we talk about community benefits. And I feel like they need to be understood and acknowledged as an essential part of any discussion when we talk about benefits for this project. Attachment one to the staff report went into great detail about this. This is just a quick example of what that attachment one looks like. I'm not going to read all of this, but you've got direct and indirect jobs, economic stimulus. There's going to be local government revenue. The school district, for instance, on the peninsula will receive significant increase in tax revenue. Then there is increased district revenue, and I'll talk about that more in a moment. The project labor agreement itself is a natural benefit. There will be infrastructure upgrades to the port, increased channel maintenance, site cleanup, site modernization, and a number of other benefits. That's not a comprehensive list. We're trying to collect these as they go, but for now, that's the list that we currently have. Built-in benefits are strategically added to the project. This is an important thing to emphasize here. So these built-in amenities were initially proposed and then formalized as part of the district's infra grant application. Once the infra grant was awarded to the district, those built-in amenities were added to the project description and the basis of our CEQA EIR. Then we lost the infra grant, but per board direction two board meetings ago, the project description continues to include those built-in amenities until board directs us otherwise.
That's a good question.
Yeah.
Might be a somewhat loaded question, but were some of those community benefits that were built into the infra project stated by the federal government as reasons for rescinding the project, or how
yes.
It didn't align?
Yes, they were.
So the inclusion of those benefits was one of the reasons given, not necessarily the reason.
That's right.
The justifications given for rescinding that.
If you recall, we submitted that application during the Biden administration, and those were listed as bonus points, things that the federal government wanted at the time. We put them in, were awarded the grant, and then the Trump administration cited several of those benefits as things that they didn't find alignment with anymore. So those built-in amenities right now do not currently have a dedicated funding source. It was infra. But to be fair, neither does the whole general base project. So we've got some fundraising to do still. We will continue to seek overall project construction funding, including those built-in amenities, unless directed otherwise by the board. Attachment 2 went into detail about those built-in benefits. I've talked about these quite a bit, so I'm not going to go into detail on these, but it includes ground-mounted solar and a dewatering area, the bike path, upgrades to the fisherman work dock here on Woodley Island, and a number of others. And I believe that this is the best way for us to provide benefits to affected parties, is to build it straight into the project. So we're in constant communication with tribes in the town of Samoa, the townhomes next to the town of Samoa, aquaculture fishermen, and other affected parties. In my opinion, it's far better for us to build benefits into the project rather than to put them into a legal agreement where we're negotiating back and forth. If it's just inherent to the project, then I see that as the best possible outcome. We've also been working with the Community Advisory Committee, which does have the word community benefit in their long name, to explore community benefit program, which was also built into infra. This is a project associated fund where competitive grants are issued to specific categories of people affected by the project. Some advantages of community benefit program is it's customizable according to need. It's flexible over time. You can constantly replenish the fund, and it has adaptable program oversight, which means that it could be administered by the district. It could be administered by a different party delegated by the district. And there's a lot of different ways to oversee the program. And that was attachment 3 in the staff report. And then there are community benefit agreements, which are project specific, negotiated with community representatives. They have explicit and measurable components to them. It is enforceable, and it's an exchange relationship, which means that particular community representative group gets something and the developer expects something. It's a, I can't remember the term I'm looking for there. So legally enforceable, project specific, the developer commits to providing specific things for either support or neutrality on the project approval. Some examples, workforce and economic benefits, local hiring, living wage, labor standards, apprenticeships. A lot of that has already been covered in the project labor agreement. There are a lot of projects out there that have housing and anti-displacement community benefits built into them. Those are almost always associated with, say, a large apartment complex that's being replaced by a bigger mixed-use development project. And so part of the project community benefit agreement is that anybody that's displaced will have a new place to move to. So that's almost always about displacement or, say, a large baseball stadium that replaces a whole neighborhood of rentals and they purchase all those rentals. It's a housing and anti-displacement is typically associated with that. Then there are pollution controls beyond regulatory minimums. This might not be feasible in our project because of the green terminal strategy where we're reducing pollution far below regulatory minimums and maybe as far as technologically feasible. That's typically about air emissions. And then there are things associated with community facilities and services such as trails and in the government and oversight, such as an ongoing advisory committee for the project, something like that. These are all projects that have something to do with renewable energy or offshore wind that have had community benefit agreements. This is all detailed in the staff report. There are a lot of good info sources about this. That first one there has a list of a whole bunch of community benefit projects where you can click on them and see details. That's all in the staff report. And then I said that I would come back to this, how increased district revenue is an inherent benefit to the project. And that's because the district was established in 1973 to do a number of things. I'm not going to go over that. It's detailed in the staff report. But our purpose and responsibilities are directly and exclusively limited to benefiting Humboldt Bay, its habitats, ecology, businesses, lands, people, and communities. We are a community benefit organization by statute. We exist to do nothing more than benefit Humboldt Bay. So any revenue acquired or managed by the district is and has to be reinvested back into Humboldt Bay and our purposes. So all activities enacted by the district and all revenue that flows through us are necessarily meant to benefit the natural and human communities of the Bay. So I kind of came up with this graphic, the nesting levels of community benefits. At the core, the best kind of community benefits are those natural benefits that just inherently occur. Then we've got built-in benefits that we voluntarily add, and then you can wrap around that benefit programs or community benefit agreements. The closer that a benefit is to the core of the project, the better it is for everyone. So if it can't be natural, then you try to build it in. And revenue to the district is a natural benefit of the project, just like tax revenue to the school district is a natural benefit of the project. So our work about community benefits is ongoing. We continue to analyze and try to add benefits to the project. As I said, unless directed otherwise, we'll continue to investigate the relevance, need, best practices, precedents, options, models for developing agreements. And at some point in the coming 18 months or so, the board will need to determine if the project should include a community benefit agreement, how the operator is going to be involved, and how agreement should be developed, structured, and administered. In the meantime, staff recommends that board members become familiar with the natural benefits of the project. That's attachment one, our built-in community amenities, attachment two, and the community benefit program, which is attachment three. And then no conversation about community benefits should be held without a fundamental understanding of those base elements. And I encourage you to be clear about the district's lack of authority or very limited involvement in community benefits for ocean-based and transmission projects. And that's the staff report.
Thank you very much. Very comprehensive. Any questions, comments, reactions from the board?
First of all, thank you, because it's really important. This is a super valuable document, because we've been meeting for months and months and months with anywhere from 7 to 11 groups, working on community benefits, and so to have it all documented like this makes it's just helpful, because we have bits and pieces of it from notes in different places. So thank you for this tremendous amount of work that you put into these attachments and looking at overall. The comment I have, other than thanking you, because this is going to be beneficial for all of us and for the community to have access to this as well. Not that they need, to the 72 documents that are already posted on our website around this project. Let's add a few more in the new year. But I also just appreciated that you called out the Harbor District as a community benefit organization, that we exist exclusively to benefit the community, that we were voted into being by this community to serve this community and in and of ourselves. I don't mean that to sound arrogant, but that we are a community benefit, but everything we do is oriented around serving this community. And so I appreciate that we sort of didn't miss the forest for the trees, or the tree for the forest in this case, in this report. So appreciate that. And I also agree that these benefits need, I love that our strategy is to bake them into CEQA so they become a legal obligation, as opposed to some other kind of an agreement that could be renegotiated at some later time with, less money or a different board, and lose its teeth. So I appreciate that. Thank you.
Any other comments?
I have to say that the unknowns are just mind-boggling moving forward with this project. And most interesting part, of course, to me is the district's role moving forward with the terminal, and how we would engage with the programs going forward with the operator. And I'm really interested to see what folks here tonight have to say about that.
I wonder, where in your bubbles of community benefit layering do mitigation efforts, because like a project like this is going to result in, multiple projects of wetland restoration, tideland, salt flood, yeah, just all sorts of restoration projects that are seen through CEQA that are seen as mitigation to the impacts. So are those natural benefits or built-in benefits of the project? And because I think there's so many projects like that that are needed around the bay, and so much work that can be done to restore habitat and natural function of the bay that need a funding source, and a project like this becomes the funding source because it's mandated that it needs to happen. So which bubble do those go down?
Yeah, I would say that those are natural benefits. So there's $50, $60 million of restoration built into the project cost estimate, and that will be restoration of contaminated lands or low quality habitat that will be brought up to higher quality habitat. So it's just a natural outcome of the project.
Thank you.
One thing I didn't add in here, and I just thought of, is there are no benefits without the project, right? There's no impacts without the project, but there are no benefits without the project. So none of this means anything if the project doesn't occur.
We can't just get all the funding for all the mitigation projects without the.
I'd like to believe, just allow me to comment, I'd like to believe that that's not entirely true.
I mean, while I understand the reasoning for it, that we need a project in order to, we need the funding that project provides, you know, to move some of these things forward. But I also feel like these community benefit programs, you know, whether natural or built in, et cetera, also provide us with a strategic roadmap that we can bring into strategic planning, just moving forward, even if this heavy lift marine terminal didn't happen, let's say, or it happened with a different client in a future generation, that we've taken this time to really discuss with the community what they're after, and it helps gives us strategic planning for us, and also maybe some of the parts that we don't have control of, but others like Vineyard Offshore, who also have community benefit programs, it provides them with a template for what does the community that we would pass these funds along to want. You know, so I'm hoping that there's several level of impact that this kind of documentation can happen, whether or not the project moves forward.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. Every day that passes while we're working on this project, we learn a lot. And even things like working with the aquaculture community has exposed vulnerabilities that I don't think the district was really focused on previously. And so with or without this project, we are now putting new effort into working with the aquaculture community in a way that we previously weren't, or not to the degree we currently are. So you're right, there are benefits every day that we learn more about the site and Humboldt Bay.
Thank you.
Thanks. So I do want to add to that, and it is true, but is it the thing that you said about the Harbor District as a community benefit organization, and that you echoed, like, so not only the built-in projects, but I mean, if this project were to be built and to go through, there would be, one hopes, revenue coming to the district from it. And that would allow us to serve that community benefit in a greater way, whatever that might be, but different priorities. And I'm sure everyone in the room and online can probably come up with, you know, a long list of things that they think the Harbor District should be our top 10 priorities. And we are funded primarily through property tax revenue now. And so to get more funding, do we increase property taxes or do we have some sort of external revenue that can do these things? So I think that shouldn't be understated, that for a district like us, bringing in revenue will allow us to accomplish more of those things, some of these recreational goals and conservation goals and community goals. So with that, now may I go to the public? Would anyone from the public care to comment on this item?
My name is Colleen Clifford. I'm a Vanilla resident and co-lead of the Peninsula Community Collaborative. Thank you for picking this up to talk with your list of the priorities to talk about. The community benefits discussion is really important to our committee. I'm also on the Harbor District's Community Advisory Committee, and I can see firsthand how the staff is reaching out to individuals and communities, organizations, and bringing us all together to keep this conversation alive. So the BCC is an organization that focuses on the well-being of our residents, as well as the beautification, health, safety of the community. And we are in continuous conversation with the residents and bringing forth their voices, as well as you see the Harbor District doing. So we are very much in support of community benefits and all the different kinds of agreements. There's so many different tools that you outlined, and we want to see all of them, anything that can help with the community. Making sure that there are lesser and lesser harms, mitigating harms, and bringing forth benefits. And we want to see that happening before the developer comes in. We want to see that plan in legally binding documents to make sure that this happens through the life of the project. And the importance of that is to show the developers our priorities, the values of our community, before they agree to jump in. For example, we love the commitment to the green terminal. That has been established early, and I still see a part of the plan today, and that is wonderful to see. It's impressive. It aligns with our values. It will prevent us from becoming another industrialized site that has pollution impacting the air and all the different ecosystems. These types of plans can provide a huge sense of relief for the residents, as we see that our elected officials are showing a leadership role rather than allowing the industry to come in on top of them. With the loss of the federal grant, we don't want to see the loss of these built-in priorities and benefits. We want to make sure that we're still attaching them to the plan and to the design of the project. That's all I wanted to say, but I also like to always add that the town of Samoa has a unique history. It's going through a unique transition. So that means we have to come at these concerns and harms with a very creative mindset, making sure that these community members who are, whether they're coming in now buying homes during the transition from a company town into individual residents or homeowners, that their voices are being heard early and often, and continuously bringing people to the table who may not have heard about this. I'm always amazed that there are still people who haven't heard about this, but they are out there for sure. So thank you so much. We appreciate the time and opportunity to keep speaking about this.
Thank you. Would anyone else care to make any public comments on this item? Hello.
Good evening, everybody. My name is Amy Jester, and I work with Core Hub. I'm also a 22-year resident of Eureka, and most of that time has been spent living near the Bay. I want to begin by expressing appreciation for the work that the staff has done to bring forth such a comprehensive discussion of community benefits. It's really exciting to see the work that you put into the packet, and I agree that it'll be a valuable tool for communities going forward, and hopefully for the board as well. While the conversation has been ongoing for some time, I think the breadth and clarity of the information presented tonight is especially valuable. I appreciate the district demonstrating continued commitment to our community during a period, as you all discussed earlier, of uncertainty and shifting conditions for offshore wind. We appreciate the inclusive and flexible framing reflected in the staff report and the recognition that meaningful benefits are best secured through a combination of tools, particularly legally binding and enforceable agreements, and building them into the project from the get-go as part of the core concept, rather than relying on a single mechanism. This approach creates a strong foundation for long-term and durable outcomes. The staff report also highlights community protections, which are a critical component of how we think about project agreements and including community benefit agreements. These agreements should not only outline benefits, but also include protective mechanisms that safeguard community interests. To that end, we strongly support the district's emphasis on prioritizing communities that may experience disproportionate project burdens, centering those communities in the development of benefit and protection strategies, and ensuring their needs are reflected in binding agreements with Central. We're largely aligned with the potential community benefit agreement topics outlined beginning on page 19 of the staff report, and respectfully offer a few additional considerations for future discussion. We encourage the district to support a community benefit agreement specific to the wind terminal project and to work with a broad cross-section of community interests to determine the district's role and how it can best leverage its authority to ensure accountability. We also appreciate the work already underway to advance community benefits and protection through binding instruments, and would like to see that continue through tools such as lease agreements, development agreements, and related approvals. These tools can effectively reinforce the district's goals of equity, environmental stewardship, and long-term community investment. They do as well for establishing the Community Engagement and Community Benefit Program Advisory Committee and for exploring benefit and protection strategies with that committee and others. We encourage the district to continue to work with your committees to figure out how to incorporate elements in agreements such as adaptive management strategies, tribal and community partner, including tribal and community partners and procurement and selection processes, and implementing the districts in the MIC resolution. Thank you for your time with you.
Thank you. Is there anyone else who would care to speak on this item? Going once, twice, three times.
Somebody from
Okay, we have somebody online. Great.
Hi, good evening. I'm Carrie Venegas from Changing Tides Family Services. And I just got off an airplane, so I apologize for doing this virtually because it's the first time I've done it. So hopefully I get it right. I'm also a member of CoreHub. So one, I just want to say thank you for this ongoing conversation and the commitment, the way it's being built in. I just feel like the progress that's been made around the issue of community benefits has been so important, and really appreciate the staff time on it and also all of you as commissioners investing this, asking the good questions. Rob, I got to hand it to you. That was an amazing diagram of the nesting. And I think it just is an excellent one that will be able to be shared in a lot of places. That makes it much more understandable how layered this conversation is and how many possibilities and options there are. And I want to continue to encourage that we keep on this track, regardless of some of the noise around us, and that this is important because by the time things may or may not shift, hopefully will shift, we'll have a really great idea of the best way to leverage all of those options and opportunities, including adaptable management plans, some of the things that are important to our community members, especially on the peninsula, things related to the workforce, including, of course, my personal favorite, childcare. And again, just want to express thank you for this.
All right, thank you. I'll ask one final time if there's anybody else either online or in person. And if not, we'll move on to the next item. Thank you, Rob. Thank you, everybody who spoke. So consider adopting resolution 2026-01, a resolution designating business matters, appointment, and authorization for the Humboldt Bay Harbor Recreation and Conservation District for calendar year 2026.
I move to adopt resolution 2026-01.
A second.
All right. This is our general calendar and business matters resolution. Anything specific that we
that is
should
correct.
Be made aware of?
I think it's important to acknowledge changes? That officers have been noted as Stephen Coleman as president, Craig Benson as vice president, Aaron Newman as secretary, Greg Dale and Jack Norton as commissioners. Also contained here is the acknowledgement of our district treasurer, our budget officer, various instruments, district council, as well as where we hold our funds, our treasurers, our revenues are flowed through, how we handle our grants, contracts, leases, and of course our monthly board meeting, as you noted, as well as there's a document here related to our pay schedule. This is necessary to support our CalPERS relationship. So this item is a resolution. If there's any questions that you'd like to ask the staff, we're happy to do it. But yes, most generally, this is a procedural matter done each and every year.
All right. Thank you. Any questions from the commission? Any questions from the public? All right. It's a resolution, so that's a roll call vote.
Okay. Commissioner Norton?
Aye.
Commissioner Newman?
Yes.
Commissioner Benson?
Yes.
Commissioner Dale?
Yes.
And President Coleman?
Yes. Great. Thank you. Moving on. Consider authorizing the execution of a municipal finance equipment lease purchase agreement with Ford Motor Credit for the acquisition of two 2026 Ford F-150 fleet trucks for district facilities operations. This is where we get to have arguments about Ford versus Chevy versus GMC.
No, we actually did the research on that. We know we've made the right selection based on the criteria staff submitted. Yeah, so as the item reads, we're looking to acquire two Ford F-150 pickups. We're going with a very standard 4x2 model. We are choosing the EcoBoost engine, which is an option that comes equipped standard with a 5-liter V8 engine. We're choosing, for very obvious reasons, to go a little bit different. Provide us an average fuel economy somewhere. Standards that I read most recently were 20 to 25 miles per gallon are what is typically received. We need a higher gross vehicle weight, so we have a much higher towing capacity and overall hauling capacity. We've chosen Ford because of its engine options, the reliability rating, the maximum towing power, and because it comes equipped with our logos. So.
Any questions or comments from the board?
Yeah, since we made a resolution to look for a zero emission terminal, it wasn't to have a complete zero emission operating strategy. But I wondered, did you look into electric vehicles?
Absolutely not. No, yes, absolutely. We actually looked at the Ford F-150 Lightning. The cost is quite considerably higher than what is really affordable to the district. Moreover, Ford recently discontinued the production of the vehicle, and it doesn't sound like the reliability in the overall vehicle achieved what it was. Not looking to argue Ford versus Chevy, but yeah, it doesn't appear to be a viable option for the district at this time. We also considered the Ford Maverick, which might have a better rating in terms of reliability. Unfortunately, due to its small size, it's not practical for facility operations. So, great question, and we absolutely did those things.
And our newest vehicle is 2010 in our fleet.
It is. It's a 2010 Ford Ranger, 96,400 and something miles. Drove it today. Yeah, we have a very aging fleet. As it says in the staff report, we've far outlived the serviceability of these vehicles. Many of them came to us secondhand. And we've been towing vehicles periodically. Each and every week, we've got something down. So it's at a point in time where it's not only for the reliability, but frankly, it's for staff safety.
Will these have trailer hookups and some
They
other
won't come
items?
equipped that way. We'll have to add them, but they are prepared. But we will have to add the appropriate towing hitch package, as well as lighting and sway bar if needed. That's the total towing stabilizer bar, rather, if needed. Typically for us, the things we haul are small trailers that are used no more than 2 ton. They're used to bring aggregate in and out of our products, asphalt, or sometimes if we have very large events, we'll have a number of debris that we'll need it for. In extreme times, we do move equipment. These won't be for heavy equipment removal, the typical rental equipment, but we do have some large scale equipment the district owns. We'll continue to use our 3/4 ton pickup that we have now. Hopefully, our controller finds a little bit more money in the budget because we kind of need to replace that one before long, and that's the truck that probably gets the greatest service.
So here's the tricky question. Who gets them?
They'll be in the general fleet. We're gonna let the
Yeah.
guys manage that. It is important to note as a requirement, there's a Friday checklist. Each vehicle is washed and vacuumed every week. Daily, they're emptied of all the trash. They're sanitized, so we have a good, healthy workforce. We are probably going to put GPS in these vehicles, and we're going to have to work with our personnel policy to put the appropriate disclosures. But we'll know where these vehicles are at all points in time, and also the activities of the vehicle. So, meaning speed, etc. There's pretty sophisticated things you can do nowadays. That'll be another board item for another time. That'll come up in a updating our personnel policy. And that's not to speak against our staff. That's just where we're moving from insurance standpoints and getting our rates to a point where they're low.
I mean, are we equalizing by getting rid of a few
We'll
from the
be
fleet?
disposing of two vehicles. We'll have the board declare a surplus property. And from that, we'll have an auction and they'll go up for bid. These vehicles very likely will be sold as parts only for salvage.
We're maintaining still some passenger cars for transporting people to conferences
We're actually using
or
rental
meetings.
vehicles for that now. The passenger cars that we have, we don't believe are reliable for long distance travel. Sorry to be
Yeah, no,
a party pooper
there's
on
a lot to
this,
go
but
more than 10 miles.
yeah, we've
We've all been stuck
been
up for too
extended.
long waiting for somebody to
I'm
come tell me
sorry
as
for
far as you
that.
could walk back.
Try not to be silly here, but no, I mean, truth be told, if we had the finances, we would replace the entire fleet. That's just simply where we're at. Our cost is very reflected in our budgets, but they're just growing exponentially. I think this year alone, we've probably spent, I don't know, well, excuse me, the prior year, I think we spent a little over $7,000, just wheels, tires, and brakes, on just the vehicles on Woodley Island. So
I'm sure you could tell us
it's
all
significant.
about the tires,
P2,
but I think
P255 70 R16
did we have a
extra
motion?
load.
I'd like to make a motion for this new business item B, authorizing execution of municipal finance equipment lease purchase agreement for to the Ford Motor Credit for the acquisition of two 2026 Ford F-150 fleet trucks for district facilities and operations.
I'll second it.
All right. Any further discussion from the board or any comment from the public? All right, then. Oh, somebody.
Hi, it's Carla Osborne, and I raised my hand before Craig asked the question, but I'm really sad to hear that you decided against electric vehicles. It just seems like such a great precedent for the new eventual marine terminal that we would start off, you know, showing the community that you guys are in the spirit of the green port and zero emissions. It seems like you would save on fuel. I don't know if the Harbor District has solar panels anywhere, but just plug them in nightly and go the next day. And they're so quiet. They would easily tow anything that you had to tow. I don't know. Maybe even a used Lightning could be considered. Just my thoughts. Thanks for listening.
Thank you. And yeah, I mean, I'll add that I'm very much in favor of electric vehicles. I drive one myself, but I do. And I spoke with Chris about this item quite a bit. And I do understand the assessment that was made as we look to replace further vehicles, especially the passenger vehicles. I would hope we look at more efficient vehicles, but I do understand with the constraints that we're working with. So I appreciate the thought, and I do agree with
absolutely.
You.
Absolutely.
So we have a motion and a second. Any further discussion? Shall we? All in favor, signify by saying aye.
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 Aye. Aye. Any opposed?
Aye. Opposed.
Okay.
So seldom say, don't say aye.
Yeah. Okay. Abstain. So we have motion passes. Four in favor, one opposed. Moving on.
Okay, so this is an item that is new business, but it relates to a previous item that was brought up. So this is consideration of an amendment to a contract between CalPERS Retirement System and the Board of Commissioners. This is a resolution, so it'll be need to be read as such. And this is basically an amendment that ties around staff's ability to opt into Social Security. So in a prior negotiating period, it was brought up that because we were fully CalPERS, there are those that would like to opt into Social Security. So existing employees had the option to opt in or not opt out, but all new employees would have a Social Security as part of their option. So what this does is it changed the retirement calculation in CalPERS, because now there's a percentage, Social Security percentage CalPERS, where others are full CalPERS. Again, this item's come before you. It was brought back to the commission. We had the pre-adoption. This is the final resolution and contract amendment to meet the requirements of CalPERS and the process in which we have to go to do so.
I'll make a motion to approve.
I'll second.
Hey, we have a motion and a second. Any discussion?
Don't forget.
You discussed this a lot, so
yeah.
I'm moving forward.
Any comments from the public or questions? Hearing none. Is this a resolution? Yes.
It is.
So roll call, please.
You bet. Commissioner Newman?
Yes.
Commissioner Benson?
Aye.
Excuse me. Commissioner Norton?
Aye.
Commissioner Dale?
Aye.
And President Coleman?
Yes. All right, great. And we'll be good. Moving on, consider another resolution. Consider adopting resolution 2026-03, establishing findings relative to Harbor District Permit 2025-05 for Caltrout Elk River Estuary Restoration Project, making CEQA responsible agency findings and approving permit 2025-05 with conditions.
All right, I'm going to make a staff report, and then we do have a project representative here if there are any technical questions about the project, but I can go over it briefly. And I am going to give just a little bit of background because it is a much larger project than the permit is approving. So I want to give kind of a context of the portion of this project that it is. So this project is one phase of a watershed scale initiative to restore beneficial uses of water and improve water quality and rehabilitate the critical habitats for special status species in the Elk River watershed, including coho and chinook salmon, tidewater goby, steelhead, and longfin smolt. The restoration is part of the broader Elk River Watershed Stewardship Program and builds on previous assessments and community collaboration. It integrates habitat enhancements with infrastructure upgrades and sustainable land management practices, making it a multi-benefit restoration project. The stewardship program held extensive meetings with Elk River adjacent landowners and others between 2019 and 2022. And the proposed actions and associated regulatory compliance strategy were presented in the Elk River Recovery Plan in 2022. And in that plan, the entire watershed area was broken up into four planning areas. And so this permit is for a portion of planning area one, the tidally influenced portion of planning area one. And it is a Caltrout led project, and including Northern Hydrology and Engineering, Stillwater Sciences, and we have a GHD representative here as well who's on the project team. So this is showing the entire watershed planning area and the the entire watershed program area and the four planning areas, with the purple area in the red box is planning area one. So like I said, it is a large scale restoration project, and the, oops.
It's me, sorry.
Okay. It will reestablish natural tidal and fluvial processes across the floodplain and transition the landscape from a modified agricultural and flood control system to more of a restored estuarine and riparian ecosystem. The property ownership within the planning area one is a mix of private properties and public agencies. An outreach and for the design portions did involve the landowners, and it was an iterative process that was reviewed by landowners and vetted with project advisory committee, and the designs did get the full support for each kind of element of the project where there was private property and private property. So this is an overview. The red box on the right is kind of approximately the tidally influenced areas, and the larger black outline is the entire planning area one. So the Harbor District's permit will just do the tidally influenced areas of the project permit within Harbor District's jurisdiction. Some of the project elements are infrastructure and removal. So removing and augmentation of existing levees, and tide channel excavation, floodplain reconnection, drainage infrastructure removal and upgrades, including fish-friendly tide gates, and creation of side channel habitat for fish rearing, and reconnecting floodplain flow paths. Additional project elements include vegetation enhancement and management that will expand native plant communities, including expansion of coastal salt marsh, brackish marsh, freshwater wetlands, coastal scrub, and riparian forest communities. And the project also includes some invasive plant management. And it's in the project is intended to beneficially reuse all of the sediments within the project area. So sediments that are excavated will be reused on the project site somewhere else. And per the project description, at this point, it looks like that does balance out. So it would the project is planned to do that. And the project includes new unpaved trails, enhanced parking areas, some new non-motorized boat launches, interpretive signage, wildlife viewing, and overlooks. And these are just some examples. So each the planning area one was further broken up into sub areas, and each sub area was designed, has engineering designs, planting plans, and it gets all of those application materials are posted on the website, but there's detailed project designs and plans for each of the sub areas within planning area one. So these are just some examples of that. The project benefits include restored salt marsh and slough networks will improve the hydrologic connectivity, increase floodplain storage, and enhance resilience to sea level rise. Native vegetation recovery will expand habitat for waterfowl and shorebirds and special status fish species. The project will also connect to other recently restored Elk River estuary habitats, including Martin Slough and the City of Eureka's project that they did in the lower Elk River, so on the west side of the highway. As part of the standard application review process, the notice of application, well, the board accepted the application for filing in November. Notice of application was sent to adjacent property owners and agencies and the tribes. We did receive a couple comment letters of support, one from a landowner and who also noted, hoping that the project would consider and help address some illegal dumping that's happens in that area. And the second comment letter was from Humboldt Community Services District, noting that they own property and infrastructure in the project area, and they have been coordinating with Caltrout and the project team throughout the process and support the project and will continue to coordinate on their property and facilities. The Harbor District is a CEQA responsible agency. So the district must review and consider the information contained in the State Water Board's program EIR for restoration projects. And the Elk River Restoration Project was found to be within the scope of that statewide general order by the North Coast Regional Water Quality Control Board, who is the lead agency. And so they also did CEQA process. And the resolution includes the permit with the conditions of approval, the CEQA notice of determination that was filed by the North Coast Regional Water Quality Control Board, and the other application materials are posted on the district's website. And then I did want to note that after the packet went out, we did receive a request from the applicant to for a 10-year permit term as opposed to the 5-year permit term that's currently in the conditions, just given the size and scale of the project. They anticipate taking beyond those 5 years and to be consistent with their other regulatory approvals. So that is up for consideration by the board to amend that condition number 4 to allow for that longer 10-year permit term. And that's the end of my staff report. And I'm happy to answer questions or pass them on to Andrea to answer a question.
Any questions or comments from the board?
I move to approve resolution 2020-603.
I'll second the motion.
Are you amending for a 10-year, or I think right now it says it's 5-year? But did you?
Yes, for Tim.
I will be second.
Aaron is nodding acknowledgement. Yes.
Yes.
Great.
Everybody's watching.
It looks like you have a comment.
I have a lot of comments on this. First of all, I'm so pleased to see this planning area one of the watershed, Elk River Watershed Recovery Plan, you know, being implemented, and it's, you know, it's been going up. I've taken my kayak into all the places that have been publicly accessible during the course of the development of these projects, and I'm just super stoked, for lack of a better word, for how beneficial this, especially at a time of sea level rise and increasing the estuarine area that's accessible and that the bay can flood into is a big part of the volume, increasing the volumetric capacity of Humboldt Bay, which helps mitigate sea level rise to some degree. We're getting a bigger bathtub over time, 9,000 acres taken out through various kinds of levee, railroad, and highway projects, and we're about 3,000 acres with this back. So that's like a third of Humboldt Bay being reclaimed back to some either muted or fully tidal prism, and that's huge. That's, you know, that's a 3,000 out of 9,000. I guess that's a C. I'd give the restoration community a C grade of C. I'm in professor mode, you know, on you know, but that's been happening since 1990s. I'd like to see it happen even faster. I just think it's super, super important. I also just want to say that, you know, while I'm pleased to see this happening in planning area one for Elk River, you know, watershed, you know, we all, those of us who've lived here for a long time, you know the long history of issues in the riverine reaches. And I know this gets out of the Harbor District's area of jurisdiction. We're really involved in the estuarine parts, but I just, you know, want to take this chance, you know, while Cal Trout is here and other, other proponents of the project, you know, that's 283 households in Elk River have been crying for relief since the 17-year late TMDL took to, you know, to finally be passed in 2014. And, you know, there's still nuisance flood issues from relic sediments. And even though the TMDL has turned down the tap on sediment, the amount of sediment that's in Elk River, especially the middle transport reaches and accretionary reaches, as depositional reaches, it still exceeds what is on scale with the $30 million project it took to dredge out Salt River. The huge project is not being addressed, you know, and the one that's impacting people the most. So we're doing well for climate change resilience and for estuarine species. And the, you know, and just looking at the Humboldt Bay Steelhead Conservation Recovery, Salmon and Steelhead Conservation and Recovery Plan, you know, this is all fitting with a master plan. So it's all green and it's all positive. But I just, sorry to grandstand a little bit, but I just don't want people to forget the 283 households that are terribly impacted by excessive sediment identified, and you know, and the Regional Water Quality Control Board, you know, gave a TMDL of 120% of background sediment. So they're allowing all the sediment that would naturally occur plus 20%. And if anyone has spent any time in the riverine reaches of Elk River, there's not a room for one more grain of sediment in those areas. Zero. It should have required dredging in order to do logging upstream. But 120% is what's sort of commonly used all over the United States. And so that part of the regional board's plan was not very aggressive. But where it was aggressive is that they limber timber cut to, you know, to up to 1.5%. So this is the first time the timber industry was ever told you can only cut so much in an area that lives off of logging and has a lot of families are connected to logging in this county. That was actually the part that was innovative, you know, to the Elk River Restoration and Recovery Plan. But in terms of actually doing work on the ground in the riverine reaches of Elk River, that is still waiting. And none of the agencies seem to want to fund it because it's tricky and there's potential for litigation. And so we're treating these areas that are low hanging fruit. And I'm all about that. I'm not naysaying to that. But I don't think that we can, but while we do that, Martin Slough and planning area one, please, oh, please, planning area two, planning area three, or maybe even in some ways more. I'll stop there.
Thank you.
Anyone else?
Vanessa, I love this project, but I kind of tend to agree with the fellow commissioner. How much increase in hydrological volume exchange is going to happen from this project? Are they going to dredge any of the main channels so that they're deeper, so they increase tidal prism, so that you move sediment out of the lower river? That's my first question. Please. Yeah, I'm going to give you all my questions up front or just start.
So, in terms of change in hydrologic exchange, no dredging plan.
And if you don't mind, could you introduce yourself for the
Yeah. Andrea, hold on. What's the PhD? How many times my client? Agent on the permit.
Thank you.
No. So, there's no dredging plan for the main Sentinel River or the main stem swing through channel. There are throughout planning area one a number of tidal tributaries, like smaller tributaries that will be created. And so I do think there will be some change to the hydraulic prism. I don't have the number for you. I will say the designs are based on some pretty extensive hydraulic modeling that Northern Hydrology did throughout the planning area. And also, you know, with respect to Commissioner Benson's comment, you know, flood risk reduction is a primary goal of the project in planning area one. There is a substantial kind of replumbing of the lower estuary that's happening here in cooperation with landowners. Just slightly upstream of the Harbor District's jurisdiction, there's a number of cooperating private landowners that have just relevant culverts crossing under your agricultural fields that like backflow, reflood, and there's this kind of way. And so this project will remove those culverts. There's new tributaries that will be reconnected to Orton Creek. So we're essentially expanding the tidal network further inland by doing that and expanding the Harbor District's jurisdiction as a result. For
Thanks.
not,
Thanks. We need that.
yeah, but to be clear, you know, this kind of replumbing of the lower estuary is very much, you know, to address flooding. It's not going to get to the other flood issues that you noted for further upstream in the watershed. You know, those are just now they're starting to work on that next phase of the project. It's all grant-funded projects with state federal funding. So I hope that generally
Well,
answers your
any
question.
dendritic channels you
Perfect.
install will increase tidal prism and will increase flow, and that will hopefully excavate some of that sediment out of the lower end. The other thing is I this is probably the best estuarine habitat we have left in the bay well, I mean, I think freshwater's got some too, but this is prime longfin smelt habitat, prime coho habitat, who both utilize those mixing zone. Is there going to be monitoring for eelgrass in any of these zones?
Yeah, absolutely. Eelgrass, increasing eelgrass habitat is another project goal. There are, you know, post-project monitoring that will happen with the environment on this monitoring requirement. You know, keep in mind for the applicant itself, like Sprouts, their statewide nonprofit organization, you know, they're pursuing this ecological and community benefits, you know, objectives specifically. You know, these forcing them to this project. And for what we've been working on for years and years and years. The other thing I just want to note, you know, Vanessa had a map up there with the project area, really a landscape level transition of ownership that's happened to support the project. There's still a number of cooperating private landowners. If you go back to the one with the red boundary parcel, you go numbers 3, 9, and upstream, just out of adjacent jurisdiction 17, were purchased from private property owners properly to California trout. Those will be transitioned to the California Department of Fish and Wildlife to expand the wildlife area. And then the number 14 was purchased and conveyed to the Yavapai. And so, you know, that's like a considerable number of acres. And these areas were converting. because of sea level rise, regardless of what the project was or wasn't going to do. But to be able to take that many acres from, private formerly ag production for restoration purposes for public benefit is also it's a tremendous benefit of the project, but also just presented a tremendous opportunity to be able to do this kind of landscape level change in cooperation with the California Department of Fish and Wildlife. Try noting that as well is a pretty significant element here in the lower watershed.
And I just want to say to to the board too, and to you, just to do that, to mitigate for no net loss of ag lands while doing restoration, and know that no net loss of wetlands is not easy to do. So thank you. I know how much gymnastics that takes to do that, and good science and good relationships with the agency. So that's really wonderful.
Thank you. Any further discussion or comments, either board or public?
Sorry, I'm not done. This is my area of expertise and interest too. So I just want to say to the Harbor District folk that, generally in watershed restoration, you start at the top and work your way down, because what was learned by watershed restoration through the 70s and 80s is lots of really cool, sexy fish habitat stuff was done, and then the sediment wedges coming through the watershed just simply covered them up, and so we're running the risk of repeating that history. It's very different to the ocean dynamics in the estuaries than just riverine reaches, but in general, while we're getting this low-hanging fruit close to in the estuarine reaches, there's still that general problem of a huge sediment wedge of relic sediment from historical logging in the 1800s, but particularly added to in the El Niño years during the Maxam buyout of Palco, and that amount of sediment that has reduced the prism of, sorry, just the cross-sectional area of Elk River by 6 feet means that what's a 5 or 10 year storm now operates as a 100 year storm in Elk River. Right. So it's just, we're still in a huge, there's a huge sediment wedge working its way down into newly restored areas over time. And they are at higher risk than in some other watersheds because of that. And so it's just something we have to stay aware of, lest we make the same mistakes that early restoration practitioner did in the 70s. That's it.
Thank you. All right, well, this is another resolution.
We did go to the public.
Oh, we did?
I think, no.
I don't think we did.
I'm not sure we did. We had some
questions. I asked if there were any comments from the board or the public, but I will officially go to the public and ask the public specifically if the public would like to make public comment. Thank you. All right, now bringing it back up. We have a roll call vote.
Commissioner Norton?
Aye.
Commissioner Dale?
Aye.
Commissioner Benson?
Aye.
Commissioner Newman?
Aye.
And President Coleman?
Aye.
A bunch of pirates.
All right. Reminding me of Bilks, but I will adjourn the meeting instead.
And you got, yeah, I saw that. So we're good.